Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Over the past 40, 50 years, certainly since the end of World War II, the government of the United States, governments of other industrial countries, and their citizens have contributed a very large amount of money to try to help developing countries deal with persistent problems like hunger and malnutrition and disease and poverty. And certainly that money has helped. But some people ask this question: why is it that, given the fact that we've spent an awful lot of money, that we haven't done better? Why haven't we made more progress on this issue? Could it be, for example, that we simply haven't spent enough? Could it be that maybe the money that we have spent is adequate, but we didn't spend it on the right things? Maybe our priorities weren't right. What exactly are the problems connected with doing international development work? Well, we'll try to talk about some of these large questions here this morning in this hour of Focus 580. And we have two guests. They are both here professors at the University of Illinois. Paul McNamara is associate professor in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics in the Division of Nutrition here at University of Illinois. He's also an extension specialist with U of I Extension in the areas of consumer economics and health economics. He's lived and worked in the Philippines and Mexico and the Gambia, and right now is involved in research and service projects in India and in Uganda, taking a look at the relationships between nutrition and health and HIV and AIDS. Our second guest, Alex Winter Nelson, is also in the Department of Ag and Consumer Economics and the Center for African Studies, and has been interested in his research in looking at the relationship between market institutions and poverty in developing countries. And he has worked in Kenya and Tanzania and Ethiopia. He's also interested in animal disease in developing countries and its spread between developing and developed economies. And we're pleased that they could both be here and spend some time with us to talk. Questions are certainly welcome. We invite people to join the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, just so we can keep things moving along, get in as many as possible. But, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you both very much for being here.
It's great to be here with you, David.
Just to begin, I think we probably have to talk about what we're talking about in the sense that I think that there are a lot of terms that might describe the activity that we're talking about. For example, I think people talk about foreign aid, which I'm sure by that they mean money that a government, like the government of the United States, spends on projects outside of the United States. But that, of course, could encompass a lot of different things. It could be emergency relief, for example, when there's a disaster. And I think that's kind of something else. What we're talking about are targeted programs that are designed to try to help with some of the kind of problems that we've, you know, talked about: hunger, disease, poverty, so forth, in the developing world. And I think also at the same time you have to acknowledge the fact that there are private individuals in this country and elsewhere also have contributed a lot of money. In fact, probably more money than the government actually has been private individuals giving money to non-governmental organizations, humanitarian, religious, and so forth to do that kind of work. So how do we sort of unpack this just to make sure that we have a clear idea of what it is we're talking about?
you're absolutely right. It is a complex mix of things that go into this. There's what's referred to as overseas development assistance or official development assistance, ODA, that includes the emergency relief you talked about, and also what I think we usually talked about as development assistance or investments for long-term development. So we could think about giving a man a fish and teaching a man to fish, the two kind of cliche distinctions. In the U.S. in 2006, that came to about $22 billion. And then the private giving from individuals to NGOs or from foundations for development projects, but non-governmental giving, was about another $22 million.
Billion. Okay.
And then you've got private remittances. So income from one private individual in the U.S. to a private individual in a developing country, which is hard to estimate, but most people think is about two times the official development assistance.
That's really interesting because I'm sure I came across a reference to that. So the money, individuals give a lot of money. Private citizens give a lot of money, probably through various kinds of organizations. But there is, if you ask, well, what's the biggest chunk of money that goes from, say, America to the developing world? It is, in fact, individuals living in the United States who are sending money back to their families in their countries of origin. That's maybe as much as this, as the government and the private NGO money put together.
That's a safe conjecture. I've never seen numbers that could say, you know, is this person sending his money to his wife? But there's certainly a lot of that. And it's certainly the case that the largest flow is those kinds of private transfers from family to family, individual to individual.
In some countries, say the Philippines, have explicit policies where they're grooming labor so that they can work in other countries in order to get those remittances sent back to the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And many other countries are doing that with their healthcare sector, employment training type of programs. So remittances are a huge part of it. I think one of the things when you think about development assistance is to keep these categories in mind, but think about if your goal is to reduce in the long term poverty, what are the effective levers of doing that? And just bringing in remittances as part of the discussion raises questions about what kinds of things outside the box should we be talking about along with official development assistance, along with private charitable giving, whether it's through foundations or private donations to NGOs. And just the mention of remittances raises things that are a little different that raise questions about development assistance. Are they effective for reducing poverty? The evidence in the literature is pretty mixed. There are some countries that receive enormous amount of remittances, but it hasn't served to reduce poverty there. Mexico is a case in point where growth has actually been pretty modest in Mexico over the past 25 years, but they receive enormous flows of remittances.
Yeah. Just one other question, because it's the kind of thing that often comes up when you read articles on this subject that has to do with how it is that the amount of money the United States gives compares with other countries. And that you read on the one hand that in total dollar amount, the United States is the biggest giver. Per capita, we're actually on the other end. We're one of the smallest. So depending on how you want to look at that, you could either say the United States is really generous or the United States is not. Is that kind of distinction, does it really matter?
I think it does, and it brings up a bunch of other questions. One is, what does our aid get us? If we're going to have a target of, say, 0.7% of GDP is channeled through official development assistance, and Bono and Tony Blair have talked about this, and the UN is working towards this, is this a worthy goal? Is this something that's really going to get us where we think it's going to get us? So if the U.S. did increase its official development assistance, what might we expect it to generate in terms of poverty reduction in the poorest countries? And then another question it raises is, once you start making distinctions, other distinctions are being raised by analysts, like the quality of the development assistance. Mm-hmm. One country might give 1% of its GDP, another country might give less, but because of conditions and tying aid so that the aid has to be spent on certain products that originate in the giving country, the effect of the aid is very different than aid that's just channeled directly to a social program, say to encourage school attendance or maternal and child health programs in a poor country. So there's a qualitative difference in types of aid, the kind of tying that happens with aid, and development assistance analysts have ways of parsing down and looking at those. And the U.S. tends to fare poorly once we start looking at conditions tied to aid, local sourcing rules sourcing with U.S. contractors, that type of thing, compared to, in general, the Scandinavian countries that have less tying.
The other area in which we the U.S. doesn't look so good is the targeting of our foreign aid. If this development assistance were primarily to do something about poverty, you would expect the aid would go primarily to the poorest countries and the poorest people in the poorest countries. About a quarter of our official development assistance goes to Iraq. Afghanistan is the second largest recipient, and then Egypt. So there's questions about how much of our official development assistance is in fact targeted towards teaching the poor to fish, if you want to go back to that cliche again. Right. It's probably reasonable that donors should have multiple goals for their foreign assistance. And the political and the strategic is a sensible thing to have out there. But when we think about how well foreign aid is or isn't reducing poverty, we need to recognize how little of the foreign aid is targeted at doing that.
Yeah. Well, according to, again, another thing that I read, that someone has estimated that, say, since the end of World War II, say in the last 40, 50 years, that the countries of the industrialized world have given, adjusted for inflation, a couple of trillion dollars they have put into this kind of effort. So sort of the big overarching question that people have asked, and I know that there is significant kind of debate between various sides in this, is, you know, given the fact that we've spent all this money, why is it that we haven't seen more positive results? You know, the third world, the developing world, we still have significant poverty and problems with hunger and malnutrition and disease and need for development. So the question that I think a lot of people ask is, why is it that we haven't gotten more for our $2 trillion or however much it is in that time? It seems that we still have the same problems and that they're almost as bad as they've ever been.
Well, a couple things in response to that. One, there's fair questions about what have we gotten, and it is about $2 trillion over the past 45 or 50 years in official development assistance flows. The first thing is we have gotten some enormous gains if we're looking at a poverty focus here. We've seen increases in life expectancy in many countries. In particular, before the AIDS pandemic hit sub-Saharan Africa, indicators on the health area and in some of the education indicators were improving. Take a country like Bangladesh. Over the past 45 years, you've seen, or since 1970, you've seen a decline in infant mortality rate from 145 per 1,000 to 48 in 2002. So a dramatic reduction in infant and child mortality in a country like Bangladesh. This is just indicative of the kind of gains that we've seen in life expectancy. It's hard to quantify how much that's worth, but I do think when people give money and when countries give money, one of the things they're actually trying to reduce is suffering and the correlates with poverty that are about the negative aspects of well-being that go along with poverty, hunger, and shortened life expectancy, those kinds of things. And so we have some gains. Another thing that we've seen is Alex brought up the point of multiple objectives. A lot of the aid in that $2 trillion figure was given to support politically during the Cold War. The U.S. would target aid towards countries in part to get support in the U.N. and in other international bodies as part of Cold War politics. So often the quality of the projects that were funded and the types of things that were funded with that aid often wasn't well considered, and it wasn't best practice type of development assistance. One of the questions now is, can we move away from these multiple objectives where we have political considerations that are at the front and move to a set of aid flows where poverty reduction is the primary focus and we're aiming to do that. I think the president's emphasis with the new Millennium Challenge accounts and the other focus on specific targets like the number of kids that are actually attending school in a country and making aid not conditional on budget reductions and structural adjustment type of features, but aid as a partnership with a country for doing certain things, having good levels of governance and low levels of corruption, indicators that are tied in with the development assistance program, in essence rewarding good performers. And so we're seeing some of those kind of responses. So I think when you think about what did we get for $2 trillion, some of it we didn't get much. In other areas, we got an enormous amount. And then another consideration to keep in mind is how does aid, if you're interested in reducing poverty, how does aid compare to other sources of financial flows that can help a country invest and move out of poverty? And we already brought in remittances, things like foreign trade for a given country. The importance of foreign trade may swamp the importance of development assistance in many African countries. Foreign trade might be 30% of GDP, whereas development assistance might be 5 to 15% of GDP. So things in the foreign trade, the price of primary materials, their exports, those kinds of things are just as important, perhaps much more important than the foreign aid flows.
Let me just real quick here, and Alex, you want to add on here. I want, for the benefit of anybody who might have just tuned in, to introduce the two of you again so people know who they're listening to. The last voice you heard, it belonged to Paul McNamara. He is associate professor in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics and the Division of Nutrition. He is also an extension specialist with extension in areas of health and consumer economics. Also here with us, Alex Winter Nelson. He is associate professor in the Department of Ag and Consumer Economics with a joint appointment at the Center for African Studies, both here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about international development assistance, how much money we spent, what we spent it on, and again, trying to look at this big question about, you know, what we have gotten for that money, and would it have had a better result if we had done something different or had taken some sort of different strategy? I guess that's the big question. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I realize this is a difficult question because really to get a better answer to that question, I'm sure that you have to look. You just can't look at the entire thing as one big chunk. You've got to say, well, let's look at what happened in country A and country B and country C and conditions in those countries and how much money went in there and what we spent the money for. Because what works and what doesn't, it's got to be very situational and among other things, it's got to depend on what conditions are like in the country that you're talking about.
A number of people have tried to look at that very question. Recently, Steve Radelet, also Paul Collier at the World Bank. In both cases, they point out what I would like to reiterate, that there has been a lot of progress. I mean, it's a perennial problem, and so we tend to feel like nothing's happening. But really, there have been tremendous changes. The sort of benchmark for poverty is the $1 a day poverty, the share of the population or the number of people who live on the equivalent of $1 a day. So you understand that it was an accounting convention. Folks figured out what you could buy for $1 in the United States in 1993. It's the people who could buy that much stuff in whatever country they're in. In 1981, a little over half the population of East Asia was in dollar-a-day poverty, was in extreme poverty. Now that's down to under 15%. So you've got a reduction from 800 million people in extreme poverty to more like 2 or 300 million people in extreme poverty. It's still a lot, but it's a tremendous gain. In Africa, that didn't happen. So you've actually seen an increase in the share of people living in extreme poverty from about 40 to about 50% now, and almost a doubling of the number of people in extreme poverty. So the question sort of is, why hasn't it worked in Africa and a few other countries, a few countries outside of Africa, or what can be done differently? Paul Collier, in a new book he wrote, The Bottom Billion, is looking at those countries that have those billion people who still live under a dollar a day, and what was the effect of aid in those countries. And the analysis he did shows that if you look at the countries that made a lot of progress and you look at the development assistance that was focused on causing growth, it probably did contribute significantly to growth, maybe an extra 5%. If you look at those bottom billion countries, aid probably helped there too. It probably increased growth by about 1% and was the difference between collapse and stagnation. So aid probably helped those countries not collapse, but it didn't succeed in giving them growth.
One of the things that people often point to as being an important issue has to do with conditions maybe the big thing is the conditions inside the country itself, and what kind of government that country has. Is it a good government? Does it function well? And I can imagine that you could have two countries, you know, country A and country B, and do this, essentially try to implement the same program, spend the same amount of money, and in one case have it be a significant success, and in the other case not. And some people will say the bottom line issue is it's not anything that we do. It's not anything that outsiders do, that it really depends on the government of that country. Is this a good government? Is it organized enough to deliver services? Do we have a problem with corruption? You know, can we make sure that however much money we put in there is actually well spent and spent on the things that we want, and it's not going to go in somebody's pocket? How much difference does this good government, bad government question make in terms of how successful a development effort is going to be?
On my experience, I worked as a part of an advisory team in the Ministry of Finance in the Gambia in the late 1980s when it was in the midst of a structural adjustment program. We were from the Harvard Institute for International Development, and we were the minister's advisors and worked with the central bank. But you get an up-close feel and understanding of these governance issues when you're in a government and working intimately in these kind of decisions in this milieu. Governance matters a tremendous amount, and I think a lot of observers rightly ascribe Africa's failures to grow in large part due to governance issues. I think the economist Jeff Sachs raises some important insights about context, which David has already raised, in history. When you look at a country like the Gambia, it's only been 35 years or so since independence, 40 years since independence, Ghana 50 years now since independence. These are new countries. Many of them are still struggling with coming up with their identity as countries, working through ethnic tensions and fundamental issues within the political economy of the country. And governance is enormously important. Where you have lower levels of corruption, you can make investments like in the infrastructure, in the public services, in the areas of health, in education, which are documented to be related with economic growth and poverty reduction. Where you have high levels of corruption, you'll have things like hospitals with no medicines, clinics without doctors, schools with missing teachers. And those things are related to lower levels of growth. So governance is really important, and there's enormous varieties in the levels of corruption and the difficulties in governance in different countries.
We're just about at a midpoint here. We have a couple of callers I want to get to. And there's also something else that we have to do here because it's the first Tuesday of the month. So let's get that out of the way, and then we'll continue our conversation. This is a test of the emergency alert system. This is only a test.
During emergencies.
And this is Focus 580 here on AM 580. My name is David Inge. And again, our guests here, Paul McNamara, Alex Winter Nelson, both associate professors in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics here at the U of I. And we're talking about international development assistance. And we have three callers I wanted to get to in just a second. I just wanted to make sure, was there something that you wanted to add to what Paul was just talking about?
A small point. I mean, we talk a lot. When we talk in terms of governance, often the issue is corruption. I think it's also important to point out capacity, that it's hard to know how to spend a lot of money well. Yeah. And intrinsically, these are difficult problems. And probably where the problems are the greatest, where the need is the greatest, you're going to have the biggest administration issues and capacity constraints.
Okay. Let's talk with some callers here. First in line is in Urbana, and it is someone on line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Very interesting subject. You guys work for the Agriculture Department, is that true?
Yes.
Like a lot of these treaties that we have, like NAFTA, and how it affected the Mexican farmers and Central American farmers, you know, by flooding their markets with cheap grain from the supposedly from Canada and the United States. Then you have these European community deals with Africa and Asia and Eurasia. And I'm not blaming the West, because I think a lot of this stuff is endemic to the countries. And one of the things I've never read is, well, I mean, it's hard to go back 400 years or 300 years, or let's say 18th century, 19th century, is a good history of Africa or Eurasia prior to colonization, which would happen in the 19th century. And if you want to, you talk about governance, modern governance, look at no governance in Somalia, like autocratic fascism in Sudan. In Zimbabwe, which at one time was, I mean, just within the last 15 years, a very successful country, which has been turned into a disaster, and South Africa, which is marginal, I mean, it's still somewhat good. I think probably when Nelson Mandela dies, who knows what's going to happen. He's just a figurehead there. But, I mean, I look at Africa and these countries sort of like, you know, oligarchies and autocracies, and the West, in the East, or like China, now is playing the Sudan card by buying oil from them and giving them money and arming them, and I mean it just goes on and on and on. The pessimism I have for this, and I'm wondering if the person who just said something about how do you spend a lot of money well, how about let's not spend any money and let Malthusian just let them self-destruct. I mean, I don't quite understand what we've been spending, and you said trillions of dollars, and I know a lot of this is manipulative politics. I mean, I understand that, but I can't quite understand what, I mean, the people in between here, the people that are trying to live their lives that are being slaughtered or starved to death because of politics or, you know, misapplication of funds, I just don't see what the point of all this is. I can't say we're the fat cat West. We sit back and just let everybody rot. But I mean, we're spending an enormous amount of sums, and it's also apparently misdirected. I'm so frustrated. Listening to you guys speak, it's like just a complete reminder of all the failings more than the positives. So I'm sorry for my pessimism, but it just seems to be so obvious. The evidence leads to that conclusion. Thank you.
All right. Well, the caller has raised enough questions to keep us going for at least another 20 minutes. Just maybe first, real quick, do you want to sort of address the overall feeling of disappointment and pessimism that he voices? And I'm sure that a lot of people would share that. Again, kind of this question that we've talked about is that, you know, yeah, we're saying that the developing world has spent $2 trillion since the end of World War II, and we still seem to have essentially the same problems.
Yeah. I think one way as an economist to look at this is to take a longer lens of economic history and keep it in mind that a lot of African countries are at the same level of livelihood that the United States was right around the time of the Revolutionary War and independence. And for the first 50 or 100 years, the nature of the U.S.'s future was very much in question. And I think a lot of us would be shocked at the economic conditions that people lived in the colonies and after independence in the U.S. So I think one thing, take a long view. Many countries haven't been independent for long. Many countries, take Cote d'Ivoire, are working to try to sort out fundamental political economy issues about how to organize themselves and how to function as a nation state. And so they need more time. Secondly, on the pessimism thing, I think one of the things the whole discussion does bring up is a question about values. And it's clear to me that a lot of people really care about the well-being of people in other countries. And for those people, the question is, suppose I want to help. How can I do it effectively? How can the dollar that I give really do something that makes a difference? And I think people that are well-to-do or have food on the table, and we see it here in our own country and in our own community, often want to help another person. And so now we're talking about it in an international dimension. It is difficult. There's distance. There's geographical problems, all these things. But many of us are motivated by a true desire to help. And so the pessimism gets countered a bit by perhaps an optimism and a desire to help and a real will to help people. And so we see that also in the debate. And there's a lot of heartening things. Like when I go to Uganda and see people working to provide care to people with AIDS in their communities, marshaling what resources they can at the local level, doing enormous things, to me that's tremendously heartening. And so for the pessimism, I think a lot of us can counter examples of effective programs, things that do work. And part of the question that I'm interested in looking at is how do we try to do things better with larger flows of funds as a country? How do we, as citizens, encourage our representatives to do more effective things? How do we do that? I'm not as pessimistic as the caller was.
I think what's reflected there in the caller's comments is widely held feeling that comes out of media images. We see the bad news a lot more than the good news. There's more than 50 countries in Africa. The caller mentioned two failed states, Somalia and Zimbabwe. We don't give aid to Somalia or Zimbabwe because the donor countries of the world recognize that those governments either don't exist in the case of Somalia or aren't governments you can work with effectively in the case of Zimbabwe. But there's lots of other countries in Africa. If you just pick two off the top of my head, Ghana and Tanzania both have great records of democratic institutions, free and fair elections. In fact, Ghanaian observers of the U.S. presidential elections at our last round were quite appalled with what they saw here in our country. So I would encourage all the listeners to look for the good news out of Africa and out of other developing countries and not paint with too broad a brush. I think it's also important to point out that there have been a lot of economic success stories in Africa as well, certainly individual stories, but also at the national level. Many African countries experienced economic growth rates well in excess of what's been the U.S. for the last few years because there are plenty of countries that have sensible governance, well-intentioned political leaders, and with a few assets, a little external resources flowing in, I can use them well and effectively.
Yeah. Maybe we can come back to some of the other points the caller made, but I have some others, and I don't want to make them wait. Let's go to another Urbana caller. This is line number two.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, you're talking about schools without teachers, hospitals without doctors or supplies. It seems to me that something much more fundamental than these institutions, and it's not particularly situational and shouldn't depend that much on corruption, is water. I mean, why are we building hospitals when we haven't even dealt with having clean water, which is much more responsible for deaths than AIDS?
Well, can you speak to
that? I
mean,
people go from this community to Malawi and build a well, and it changes everything. If this were being done on a massive scale.
Yeah. Water is a big priority, and a lot of people recognize water as one of the areas in which small investments can have a big payoff. You mentioned folks from this community going to help dig shallow wells in Malawi, providing some external resources like piping and pumps that local people can't afford. mixing that with local people's labor and providing clean water to save lives. That is perhaps part of a package or part of a view that there are a lot of simple things that could be done to make a huge difference in Africa and in other parts of the world where people live in extreme poverty. That'd be the view of Jeffrey Sachs, mm-hmm. who's been pushing hard to have the world, the donor world, double its total giving. And by doing that, according to his calculations, could provide clean water, decent health care, electrification, a few other key investments, simple things that we know how to do that would enable the poorest people to earn an income and sustainably keep themselves out of poverty, out of extreme poverty, move them essentially from that $1 a day poverty to $2 a day poverty, which is often the difference between life and death.
Yeah. I realize here this will get us into a long discussion, and I do have another caller I want to make sure that we get to. But this, it seems that here gets it to an important question and a big subject of debate in this whole field, and that is, you know, say you have an organization like the United Nations that has very big, ambitious, highly detailed plans for developing and dealing with poverty. 70-point plans with 120 subpoints and 1,000 different programs with worthy goals. Some people would say it's just too much, it's too big, it's too complicated. They would look at examples of, say, you have an NGO, a non-governmental organization that has a really tight focus. They're working on one problem in one place. Or, say, the kind of effort that the caller talks about here, where actually people from the United States are actually themselves doing direct action, direct involvement. It seems that often it's the smaller scale, more limited efforts where you seem to get the most out of the money that you're putting into it. And I suppose that some people would say, It would make more sense if we just did that, and worked on smaller scale, more limited kind of programs rather than these gigantic multi-billion-dollar programs that governments are involved in.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to the small scale and the direct action approach, and you can think of the different arenas that NGOs are active in and how they play a role in reducing absolute poverty. But when you get to the issue of scaling up and trying to affect, you know, 300 million people in a country like India, NGOs are one strategy. But another strategy that some countries are looking at now that is a large-scale approach is to turn it around and not try to organize a program, but try to figure a way to transfer income directly to poor people, conditional on their doing certain behaviors. And Mexico has done this with the Progressive Program. Other countries in Latin America are doing this. Now some African countries are looking into it for targeted populations. And that idea of a conditional cash transfer is an idea that can be scaled up to a national level and does take advantage of individual action, individual behaviors, so it doesn't necessarily take a elaborate coordination of all kinds of actions and functions, but relies on mothers to do certain things, children to attend school, and in many places have been very effective in terms of reducing the correlates that are associated with deep poverty. And so that's another way that people should be aware of that is large, scalable, and coordinated collective action through a government is a counterpoint to direct action by small groups and NGOs. I think there's plenty of room for both of these kind of approaches, and they're not mutually exclusive.
Okay. Well, let's talk with another caller here, Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to make a literary reference to start with. Our Malthusian earlier should go to Swift and look what how he responded modestly to the idea that the South should die. He's also got the directions wrong. It's not blaming. He didn't want to blame the West. It's you should blame the North, the industrialized North. That's the problem. And I have a problem with the whole premise too of the discussion about the $2 trillion spent. Up until just perhaps a few years ago, when debt relief went through, and I'm not even sure it's true now. I don't have the figures in front of me. But more capital was extracted from the continent of Africa than was put in development aid. So the idea that, you know, the West is north, whatever direction, has been beneficent, it's not true. We've been, more capital has been extracted from Africa, and that's not even looking at the manipulation of commodity prices and fire sale prices for cashews out of Mozambique or whatever you want to say. As far as corruption, the U.S. is the last place to look for. We have a vice president whose name is on a legal process in France about bribing Sonny Abacha in Nigeria in the 80s. So, you know, and then Wolfowitz gets appointed to the World Bank. As far as water goes, the reason I think why there's not more emphasis on that kind of development is because that's seen as a growth industry. World Bank wants to, you know, help cut deals that'll get Bechtel or Suez or some multinational the contract for supplying water. So they see the indigenous people, these low-level, more appropriate solutions, alternative solutions, as competition. Well, I remember the issue of Cochabamba, where they were going to not even let people put out water-gathering barrels off of their roof water. I mean, it's outrageous, and I think that we should hear more from 50 years is enough, and the people that are just calling for absolute collapse of the Bretton Woods arrangement, World Bank, IMF, maybe John Perkins, who I still think we haven't heard from, the economic hitman. He actually has a couple new books out. But, yeah, I could yammer on for a while, like one of the previous callers. But I just wanted to, if I could, one thing to focus on is that more capital was extracted out of the continent of Africa, of all the nation states, than was put in. This $2 trillion looms small. Thanks. I'll just hang up because time is short.
Yeah, we're having a little feedback problem there. I'm not sure what that's about. You want to respond to some of what the caller said?
I would. I think he actually raises some good points, and I think it gets to something that Alex and I have been trying to communicate, is that you need to keep these development flows, aid flows, in perspective. There is this debate going on about what level should countries be giving in terms of a percentage of their GDP. But we've pointed out that other flows like remittances, like private giving that can be sent to a family member, or the private NGO giving. And then the caller brings up, net returns to investment, or in the case of Africa, you're thinking about profits from mining companies and timber and logging, these kinds of things. These kind of flows are in many cases much, much bigger than the flows associated with official development assistance. So important to keep in mind. And I think the caller makes a good point. There are a lot of cases where Zaire in Congo, for example, where aid has been tied with activities of multinationals and support for governments that would let multinationals operate, and then a large portion of that aid disappears and is pocketed by leaders. It's part of it. I think the caller raises some good points that come back to some things that Alex and I have mentioned. I think going forward, we as citizens need to say we want to, if you're interested in poverty reduction, make that point clear. And also we need to think outside of the box. What kinds of things should we be doing that maybe don't run into these problems of governance and other issues that we've funded? How can we do it? And I think there's a number of things out there that we should be talking about.
Something that the caller really raised, and I think an earlier caller raised too, that we haven't really touched on, is the effect that price supports and tariffs in the developing world have on agriculture in the north, the developed world, that is tariffs and price supports in the north, in the west, whatever you want to call it, the effect that that has on agriculture and people's ability to feed themselves in the developing world. How serious an issue is that?
Well, it's a very serious issue. Certainly, there's been a lot of publicity and a lot of information out about the cotton debate and the reality that U.S. cotton policies do encourage greater production, considerably greater U.S. exports, depressing the price of cotton on the world markets, and contributing to poverty in Africa among smallholder cotton producers. It gets a little more confused when you think about food commodities like corn or maize. Many countries in Africa are food deficit and might in fact benefit from lower food prices. So ethanol begins to look like a very frightening thing for those countries that are large food importers. I'm not quite sure where you want to go with that.
I think another thing to follow on what Alex just pointed out is that it's important, but it's important also to grasp the potential magnitude. And even in the case of cotton, if studies have shown that even if we were to get away with reduce U.S. subsidies for our cotton producers here in this country, the impact on the world price would be about 15%. And looking at the experience of a country like Burkina Faso, when the CFA was devalued from 50 to 100 per French franc, and looking at the response in rural poverty, which was almost we didn't observe any response really in reductions in rural poverty when that that currency was devalued, where we would expect it to have an impact in, on agriculture in a country like Burkina Faso, makes me think 15% change in the cotton price, we may not see much, even with smallholders in a country like Burkina Faso. So we need to be careful. I think realistically, you know, there's not just one thing that is going to reduce and move a lot of people in sub-Saharan Africa from absolute poverty to that next level, or as Jeffrey Sachs talks about, getting up on that first rung of economic development. How do you help them get up there? And it's going to take a number of things, a number of things we probably need to stop doing, like subsidizing our cotton producers, and a number of things that we need to start doing, like investing in technologies and in research that actually is applicable in a place like Burkina Faso, which is very different than where most of our research and thinking is going into right now, and the same with health investments.
We want to try to get at least one more caller, maybe two. We have two people on here who are holding. Next in line is Elburn up in northern Illinois, line four. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, you know, interesting discussion. I was wondering, you know, with the crisis that we have in this country, foreclosures and whatnot, do you see this country going bankrupt the next few years? I mean, that I see a downhill trend, and regardless of what the stock people say, I'm seeing it every day. And to me, it makes no sense to, you know, right now we should be taking care of the USA and not Africa and not other places. You know, everybody looks up to us, but there comes a time and a place in the world today where I find it necessary to try and find jobs for the homeless here, you know, and try to put, since we have an influx of illegal immigrants, I'd like to see something done there instead of going to other countries. I'd like to hear what your response is. Thanks, guys. Have a good week.
Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to bear in mind that there are self-interested reasons to be interested in the fate of countries abroad. Certainly, it's not in our interest to have failed states. And when economies collapse, the polities tend to collapse, and we get situations like Somalia, which are very likely to become terrorist havens if you're worried about that. Poor countries and failed states are also reservoirs for other things that spread across borders, like diseases. It's not in our interest to have avian influenza endemic in Africa because birds fly. It's not in our interest to have failed states in Africa because violence spreads across borders also. And it's in our economic interest to have wealthier, more affluent trading partners. When countries go from being extremely poor to being just a little bit poor, they buy a lot more U.S. corn and a lot more of other U.S. exports. It's not selfless that we would think about foreign assistance.
We just, as a way of, unfortunately, we're coming down to the point where we have to finish. But I guess it's a point that's probably worth making, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because we have been talking about really significant amounts of money, spending a lot of money. At the same time, you'd have to say the amount of money the United States spends on what can be classified as foreign aid compared with all of the other things that we're spending money on is really a very small amount. You know, we're spending far more money on a lot of other things. So if we took all of that money we were spending on foreign aid and put it into domestic social programs, you wouldn't notice.
No. It's well under 2% of the federal budget.
It is well under 2%. Yes. And if you look at something like what we spend on agriculture assistance, it's in the millions of dollars per year, where many of the poor people that we're talking about today are dependent on agriculture, and we're not doing much there. So in a year, we're not spending, in terms of official development assistance, that much. I think there are self-interested reasons. There's also clearly, for many of us, just a moral and ethical dimension to this that we're interested in.
Well, I think that we're pretty much going to have to finish up because we've come to the end of this hour of the program. I'm sure, though, on other days we'll get back to some of these issues once again. But for right now, we'll have to say thanks to our guests, Paul McNamara and Alex Winter Nelson. They're both associate professors in the Department of Ag and Consumer Economics. In addition, Paul McNamara is an extension specialist with U of I Extension, and it works in areas of health and consumer economics. Also, Alex Winter Nelson has joint appointment in the Center for African Studies at University of Illinois. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.